The secretary had cleaned this up in the minutes to read there was nothing out of the common about his features. Leggett had thought it snobbish at the time, but now he could see what the Prime Minister had meant. It was almost compelling how nondescript he was, more so even than when he had glimpsed him from the street 6 years earlier. He looked like a lodger who always kept himself to himself, or a night watchman who disappeared in the morning as soon as the workers arrived. He found it hard to drag his gaze away, and when he did, he realised that the gathering was breaking up. People were moving towards the door. Chamberlain was already on his feet. He made haste to intercept him. "Excuse me, Prime Minister."
"Yes?"
The Prime Minister turned round. "I wondered if I could trouble you for a moment." Chamberlain glanced at him, and then at the red box. "No," he said irritably. "Not now." He walked out of the room. Almost at once Leggett felt someone come up behind him and grip his elbow. Wilson's voice was a warm breath in his ear.
"Hugh, what on earth are you doing here?"
The other delegates continued to leave, stepping around them to get to the door.
"I'm sorry, sir. Lord Dunglass told me there was an agreement, so I came to see if I could be of any assistance."
He lifted the red box, carrying papers back to the hotel and so forth.
"Is that so?"
Wilson looked sceptical. "Well, you could have saved yourself the journey. The deed is done." Hartman watched them emerge from the study, Chamberlain first, with Henderson, and then the French diplomats, Rocha, Clapier, François Poncet. Léger peeled away from the others and went over to fetch Daladier, still sitting in the corner with his beer. The French Prime Minister slowly got to his feet. Then Leggett came out with Wilson, who was holding his elbow like a plain-clothes detective who had made an arrest. They passed within a few paces of him. Leggett glanced briefly in Hartmann's direction, but did not acknowledge him. After a few minutes, Hitler appeared with Mussolini, followed by Ciano and Ribbentrop. They walked off in the direction of the big dining room. Hartmann tried to interpret the meaning of the little pantomime he had just witnessed. Leggett, presumably, had read the memorandum, had brought it to the Führerbau, and had tried to speak to Chamberlain about it, but had arrived too late. That seemed the most logical explanation. An adjutant came over and collected his translations. Then suddenly Kort was bearing down upon him, waving him urgently to his feet. "Hartmann, come with us. Hurry up and straighten your tie. We've been asked to join the Führer for dinner."
"Really, Kort? How appalling. I don't think I can face it." "It isn't optional. These are Weizsäcker's orders. The British and the French won't dine with the Führer, and so it is necessary for us to make up the numbers. Come!"
He held out his hand. Reluctantly, Hartmann rose, and together they walked around the first floor towards the other side of the building. He said, "Are the British and the French coming back tonight?"
"Yes, after dinner, to sign the agreement."
So it was not entirely done yet, thought Hartmann. Although the chance of disrupting it was so tiny, he rather despised himself for even considering it. Nevertheless, he was able to force a more cheerful expression onto his face as he entered the room. Hitler was seated in the centre of the immense table with his back to the windows. Mussolini and Ciano were on either side, Weizsäcker and Ribbentrop directly across from him. His guests were being served wine. He had a bottle of mineral water. As Hartmann crossed the long panelled salon, he noticed those he recognised, Göring, Himmler, Hess, Keitel, Atholico, perhaps 16 men in all, no sign of Sauer. It was far too small a group for such a big space. The atmosphere was awkward. Waiters were clearing away the settings from either end of the table. Hartmann took a chair on the opposite side to Hitler, as far away from him as he could, next to the Italian, Anfuso, who was head of the foreign ministry in Rome. Even so, he was close enough to the Führer to be able to observe him quite plainly, moodily picking at a roll and making little attempt at conversation. He looked as if he was brooding on this snub from the British and the French. The silence seemed to infect those around him. Even Göring was muted. Only when bread soup was served did the Führer appear to brighten somewhat. He sipped at it and then dabbed his moustache with his napkin.
"Duce," he began, "do you not agree that one may observe the decay of a race in the faces of its leaders?"
The remark was ostensibly a question, and in theory directed at Mussolini, but posed in a voice sufficiently loud to carry across the table, and in a tone that implied no answer was required. Other conversations fell silent. He sipped a little more soup.
"Daladier, to some extent, I exempt from this rule.
The French are undoubtedly decadent. Leger is from Martinique and plainly has negroid ancestry, but Daladier's appearance possesses character. He was an old soldier, just like you and I, Duce. Daladier, yes, one can get on with him well enough. He sees things as they are and draws the proper conclusions. Mussolini said, he just wanted to drink his beer and let his advisers get on with it.
Hitler seemed not to have heard him.
But Chamberlain!
He pronounced the name with sarcastic distaste, extending the vowels so that it sounded like an obscenity.
This Chamberlain haggles over every village and petty interest like a market stallkeeper. Do you know, gentlemen, he wanted assurances that the Czech farmers expelled from the Sudetenland would be permitted to take their pigs and cows with them. Can you imagine the bourgeois triviality of a mind that can be bothered with such details? He demanded indemnities for every public building. I enjoyed François Poncet's remark. What, even the public lavatories?
There was laughter around the table. Hitler was not to be deflected.
Chamberlain! He was even worse than the Czechs would have been. What has he got to lose in Bohemia? What is it to do with him? He asked me if I like to fish at weekends. I never have weekends, and I hate fishing.
More laughter. Chiano said, do you know what they call him in Paris?
Chamberlain.
Hitler scowled at him. He was clearly annoyed at these interruptions. Mussolini gave his son-in-law a reproving look. The smile shrank on Chiano's full lips.
The Führer resumed, it's time Britain learned she has no right to play governess to Europe. If she can't stop interfering, then in the long run, war cannot be avoided. And I'll fight that war as long as you and I are still young, Duce, because this war will be a gigantic test of strength for our two countries, and it will call for men in the prime of life at the head of their respective governments, not these decadent, pin-headed old women and negroes.
There was much applause and banging of the table. Hartmann glanced across at Court, but he was examining his soup plate. Suddenly he could take it no longer. As the waiter surrounded the table to clear away the first course, he laid down his napkin and pushed back his chair. He had hoped he might be able to sidle away unnoticed, but just as he was rising to his feet, Hitler glanced along the table and noticed him. A puzzled look crossed his face.
How dare someone leave when he was speaking?
Hartmann paused in mid-crouch.
My Führer, excuse me. I am needed to help with the translation of the agreement.
A finger was raised.
One moment.
Hitler leant back in his seat and summoned a white-jacketed SS adjutant who stepped smartly to his side. Hartmann slowly straightened. He was aware of all eyes on him. Mussolini, Göring, Himmler, all seemed faintly amused by his predicament. Only Kort looked rigid with horror. The adjutant began moving around the table towards him. After what seemed to him a long time, but in reality must have been only a matter of seconds, the adjutant reached Hartmann and presented him with his watch. As Hartmann left the room, he heard the familiar voice rasping behind him.
I never forget a personal obligation. For Germany, I am prepared to be dishonest 1,000 times. For myself, never!
Chapter 9. Leggett had been sent on ahead in the first car by Wilson to make sure the Prime Minister's dinner arrangements were all in hand. He had spoken to the manager, who had assured him a private dining room had been made ready on the ground floor. Now he waited by the entrance of the Regina Palast for the return of the rest of the British delegation. He felt he had made the most appalling fool of himself. Wilson had been perfectly civil about it, but that was almost the worst thing. He could imagine words being had when they returned to London, a brief conversation between Cleverley and Cadogan, a discreet summons to the principal private secretary's office, a posting to somewhere less high pressure, a legation perhaps. And yet, stubbornly, he remained certain his duty was clear. Chamberlain should be made aware of the existence of the memorandum before the agreement was signed. The convoy of Mercedes limousines roared into the Maximilianplatz to even louder cheers from the crowd opposite. If anything, the numbers and the excitement seemed to be growing in anticipation of the announcement of a deal. As the Prime Minister, accompanied by Danglars, entered through the revolving door, the hotel guests, many in evening dress, stood and applauded him across the lobby while the string quartet played "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow." Chamberlain nodded to left and right and smiled, but the moment he reached the sanctuary of the dining room, he flopped down into the large gilt chair at the head of the central table and asked in a hoarse voice for a whiskey and soda. Leggett set down the red box and went over to the tray of bottles arranged on one of the side tables. The walls were mirrored panes, Versailles style, with electric candles in sconces. As he squirted the soda into the tumbler, he was able to keep an eye on Chamberlain in his seat beneath the chandelier. The Prime Minister's chin slowly tilted forwards onto his chest. Danglars put his finger to his lips, and the others came in quietly. Wilson, Strang, Ashton Watkin, Henderson, Kirkpatrick. Only Malkin had not returned to the hotel. He had stayed behind to oversee the final drafting. They tiptoed around the Prime Minister, speaking in whispers. The Scotland Yard detective closed the door and stationed himself outside. Wilson came over to Leggett. He nodded towards Chamberlain and said quietly, "He's in his 70th year. Been up for 15 hours, flown 600 miles, and endured 2 negotiating sessions with Adolf Hitler. I think he's entitled to feel tired, don't you?" He sounded protective. He took the whiskey and soda and placed it gently in front of the Prime Minister. Chamberlain opened his eyes and peered around him in surprise, then sat up straight in his chair. "Thank you, Horace." He reached for the glass. "Well, that was pretty good hell, I must say. Still, it's done, and I don't think anyone could have handled it better." Henderson said, "Oceans of ink will flow in criticism of your actions, Prime Minister, but millions of mothers will be blessing your name tonight for having saved their sons from the horror of war." Danglars said quietly, "Hear, hear. You're very kind." The Prime Minister finished his whiskey and soda and held out his glass for a refill. He was visibly reviving, like a drooping flower given fresh water. Colour infused his gaunt grey cheeks. Leggett fixed him a fresh drink, then stepped out of the room to see what had become of their food. A few guests loitered outside. They tried to peer round him to get a glimpse of Chamberlain. Approaching across the lobby was a line of waiters bearing silver-covered dishes, like trophies, above their heads. Dinner was chanterelle soup followed by veal and noodles. At first the conversation was constrained by the presence of the waiters, until Wilson asked Leggett to tell them to leave. But as soon as the door had closed, and the Prime Minister had started to ask if there was any news from London, Kirkpatrick had pointed at the ceiling. "Excuse me, sir, before you go on, I think it would be wise to assume every word we utter is being overheard."
"I don't care if it is. I'm not going to say anything behind Hitler's back I haven't said to his face."
He laid down his knife and fork. "Has anyone spoken to Edward or Cadogan?" Henderson said,
"I spoke to the Foreign Secretary. He was most encouraged by the news."
Wilson said quietly,
"What we require, Prime Minister, if I may say so, is a point-by-point list of all the concessions you have succeeded in bringing out of the Germans, compared with what they were demanding before we came to Munich. That will be very useful in dealing with any criticism when we get back to London."
Strang said, with a trace of scepticism,
"So there have been concessions?"
"Oh, indeed. And they're not negligible.
A phased occupation by October 10th, rather than invasion on the 1st. An orderly evacuation of the Czech minority under international supervision. A mechanism for settling any disputes that arise."
"I wonder if the Czechs will see it like that."
"The Czechs," murmured Chamberlain.
He had lit a cigar and pushed back his chair.
"We have rather forgotten about the Czechs."
He turned to Leggett.
"Where are they now?"
"Still in their room, Prime Minister, as far as I know."
"You see, now why does Hitler have to treat them like that? It's so impolite. It's so unnecessary, as much as anything else."
Henderson said,
"You have prevented him from bombing them, Prime Minister, which is what he most wanted to do. Therefore, all he can do now is inflict petty humiliations upon them. They should be grateful they are not confined to an air raid shelter."
"But suppose, after the way they've been treated, they reject the agreement. Then we shall all be in the most frightful mess."
A brief silence fell over the room.
Wilson said grimly, "Leave the checks to me.
I shall explain the realities of the situation. Meanwhile, you should go and rest before the signing ceremony. I expect there will be photographers. Hugh, will you go and fetch the checks?
Of course, Sir Horace. Leggett put down his napkin. His meal was entirely untouched.
Hartman closed the door of the banqueting hall and stopped to fasten his watch. It was 10:20. From the office along the corridor came the faint sound of typing. A telephone rang. Again he took the service stairs, descending all the way to the basement. He turned right along the passage, past the noisy kitchens, and through the smoky, steamy cafeteria, filled, as usual, with soldiers and drivers. He went past the guard room and out into the courtyard. He lit a cigarette. The cars were mostly unattended, parked bumper to bumper. The keys were in the ignitions. It crossed his mind to borrow one, but he decided against it. Better to take his chances on foot. The clouds were low, holding in the heat of the day. The sky was feverish with the reflected light from the spotlights trained on the swastikas and Königsplatz. He could hear the noise of the crowd. He set off towards the street. He had an uneasy sense that he was being watched or followed, but when he looked back, all he could see were the gleaming rows of black limousines and the massive shape of the Führerbau looming above them. The lights were burning in the tall windows. He could clearly make out the banqueting hall because of the figures of the waiters passing back and forth, where, no doubt, Hitler was continuing to expatiate on the degeneracy of the democracies. Leggett had braced himself for an argument with the Gestapo men guarding the Czech delegation, but when he explained, in his stiff German, that the British Prime Minister wished to brief the representatives of the Czech government on the progress of the talks, he was told that this was permissible, providing the gentleman did not attempt to leave the hotel. He knocked on the door. It was opened by Masary, the foreign ministry official from Prague. He was in his shirt sleeves. So, too, was the older man, Masny, the Czech minister in Berlin. The room was full of cigarette smoke, even though the window had been thrown wide open. On the bed was a chess set. A game was in progress. Masny was sitting on the edge of the mattress, one leg folded across the other, his chin resting in the palm of his hand, studying the position of the pieces. On the desk were the remains of a meal. Masary saw Leggett glance at it.
"Oh, yes," he said scathingly. "You may inform the Red Cross that the prisoners have been fed."
"Sir Horace Wilson would like to talk to you."
"Wilson? What about the Prime Minister?"
"He is busy, I'm afraid."
Masary said something to Masny in Czech. Masny shrugged and made a brief reply. They started putting on their jackets. Masny said,
"It will be exercise, at least. We have been held in here for nearly 5 hours.
"I'm sorry for the whole situation. The Prime Minister has been doing everything he can." He led them out into the corridor. The Gestapo men followed close behind. He decided to conduct them round to the rear of the hotel and down the back stairs. He didn't want them accidentally running into the Prime Minister. It was shabbier at the back than the front. The Czechs, alert for any fresh slight, noticed immediately. Masary laughed.
"They are making us use the servants' entrance, Wojciech."
Leggett winced. He was glad he had his back to them. The whole business was becoming increasingly embarrassing. The logic of the British position was, in theory, impeccable, but it was one thing to adjust lines on a map in Downing Street, another to come to Germany and do it face to face. He thought of the memorandum lying downstairs in the Prime Minister's red box. The incorporation of Austria and Czechoslovakia within Germany would provide, from the politico-military point of view, a substantial advantage, because it would mean shorter and better frontiers, the freeing of forces for other purposes. The private dining room was empty, apart from Wilson and Ashton Watkin and a couple of waiters clearing away the dirty plates. Wilson was smoking a cigarette, a thing Leggett had never seen him do before. When Ashton Watkin introduced him to the Czechs, he transferred the cigarette to his left hand and showered ash onto the carpet.
"Let's sit down, shall we?"
The waiters left. Ashton Watkin handed him a small, rolled-up map. Wilson brushed a few fragments of food from the tablecloth and spread it out. Leggett stood behind him.
"Well, gentlemen, this is the best we were able to do for you."
The territories that were to be transferred to Germany were marked in red. The eastern half of the country was mostly unscathed. In the western half, however, three large chunks along the border around the cities of Eger, Aussig and Troppau had been excised like bites from a piece of meat. An area to the south, adjacent to what had once been Austria, was shaded a lighter pink. Its fate, Wilson explained, was to be settled by plebiscite. At first the Czechs seemed too stunned to speak. Then Massari burst out,
"You have given the Germans everything they asked for.
We have only agreed to the transfer of those areas where a majority of the population is German.
But with them go all our border fortifications. It renders our country indefensible.
I'm afraid you shouldn't have built your fortifications in areas which were bound to be disputed once Germany was back on her feet." Wilson lit another cigarette. Leggett noticed that his hand was shaking slightly. It was a brutal business, even for him. Mastny pointed to the map.
"Here, at the narrowest point, Czechoslovakia will only be 45 miles across. The Germans will be able to cut our country in half within a day."
"I am not responsible for the realities of geography, Your Excellency."
"Yes, of course, I understand that. However, the government of France assured us that after any agreement, our borders would still be defensible, that geographic, economic, and political realities, as well as race, would be taken into consideration."
Wilson spread his hands.
"What can I say? Hitler takes the view that this has been the original sin with Czechoslovakia from the start. Yours is an economic and political unit, and not a nation. Race, for him, is the sine qua non. He is unyielding on the point."
"I'm sure he would yield if the British and French stood firm."
Wilson smiled and shook his head. "You were not in the room, Mr. Mastny. Believe me, he hates the fact he's even having to negotiate on this issue at all."
"It is not a negotiation. It is a capitulation."
"I disagree. This is the best deal we're going to get. 90% of your country will remain intact, and you will not be invaded. Now, I suggest you talk to your government in Prague and advise them to accept it."
Massari said,
"And if we refuse?"
Wilson sighed. He turned to Ashton Gwatkin.
"Why don't you spell it out, Frank? I don't seem to be getting through."
"If you refuse," said Ashton Gwatkin slowly, "then you will have to settle your affairs with the Germans absolutely on your own. That is the reality. Perhaps the French may tell you this more gently, but you can take it from us that they share our views. They are disinterested."
The Czechs looked at one another. They seemed to have run out of things to say. Finally, Mastny gestured to the map.
"May we take this?"
Wilson said, "Of course." He carefully rolled it up and handed it over.
"Hugh, will you show our friends back to their room, and ask if they might be allowed to use the telephone?"
Leggett picked up the Prime Minister's red box and opened the door. In the corridor, the two Gestapo men were waiting. He stood aside to let the Czechs pass. Wilson called after them,
"I shall make sure the Prime Minister sees you personally to explain everything once the agreement is signed."
Leggett didn't hear him. Across the lobby, beyond the potted palms, standing by the reception desk and talking to the concierge, he had just spotted the unmistakable tall figure of Paul Hartmann. It took Leggett a few seconds to recover his equilibrium. He said to the senior of the Gestapo men,
"It is imperative that Herr Massari and Dr. Mastny are allowed to speak to their government in Prague as soon as possible. I trust I can rely on you to see that this is done."
Without waiting for a reply, he set off across the foyer towards Hartmann. Hartmann saw him coming, but instead of indicating some discreet corner where they might talk, as Leggett had expected him to do, he advanced towards him.
"Have you read it?"
"Yes."
"Have you spoken to Chamberlain?"
"Keep your voice down." "No, not yet."
"Then I must do it immediately. He is on the third floor, yes?"
He moved towards the stairs.
"Paul, for God's sake, don't be stupid."
Leggett hurried after him. At the bottom of the staircase he caught his arm. He was smaller than Hartmann, and the German was determined, but at that instant his desperation made him the stronger, and he stopped him.
"Wait a minute. There's no point in being a bloody fool."
He spoke quietly. He was aware of people looking at them.
"We need to talk about this."
Hartmann turned to address him.
I will not have it on my conscience that I did nothing.
I understand entirely. I feel the same way. I've already tried to raise it with him once, and I promise you I'll try again.
Then let us do it together now.
No.
Why not?
Leggett hesitated.
Hartman said,
"You see, you have no answer."
He brought his face very close to Leggett's.
"Or are you worried it will damage your career?"
He began to climb the stairs. After a moment, Leggett followed him. The jibe had stung.
Why?
Because it had an element of truth? He tried to work out where everyone was. Wilson and Ashton Gwatkin were still in the dining room, although they would no doubt be leaving at any minute. Malkin was at the conference. The others were probably in their rooms or in the office, trying to talk to London. The Prime Minister was supposed to be resting. It might just be possible.
All right, he said. Let me see what I can do.
Hartman's face broke into the familiar, wide smile. At Oxford, someone once said you could warm your hands at it.
You're a good man, Hugh.
They climbed the stairs to the third floor. Halfway along the corridor, the Scotland Yard detective was in his usual position, stationed outside the Prime Minister's suite. Leggett was regretting his decision already. He said,
I warn you, he is old and obstinate and exhausted and pretty close to the end of his tether. If he does agree to see you, don't, for God's sake, give him a moral lecture. Just give him the facts.
Wait here. He nodded to the policeman and knocked on the door. In his anxiety, he realized he was twisting his hands together. He thrust them into his pockets. The door was opened by the Prime Minister's doctor, Sir Joseph Horner of University College Hospital. He was holding a black rubber bulb attached to a rubber tube with a pressure gauge. Behind him, Leggett could see Chamberlain without his jacket. His right shirt sleeve rolled above his elbow. Leggett said,
I'm very sorry, Prime Minister. I can come back later.
No, come in. I was just having my blood pressure checked. We've finished, haven't we?
Indeed, Prime Minister.
Horner began packing his stethoscope and sphygmomanometer into his Gladstone bag. Leggett had never seen Chamberlain without his jacket before. His arm was surprisingly muscular. He rolled down his sleeve and fastened his cuff.
So, Hugh?
Leggett placed the red box on the desk and unlocked it. He waited until Chamberlain had put his jacket back on and Horner had left the room with a grave,
Good night, Prime Minister.
We have come into possession of a document which I think is significant. He handed Chamberlain the memorandum. The Prime Minister gave him a puzzled look. He put on his spectacles and flicked through the pages.
What is it?
It appears to be the minute of a meeting Hitler held with his senior military commanders last November, in which he explicitly commits himself to war.
And how has it come to us?
A friend of mine, a German diplomat, gave it to me this evening, in strict confidence.
Really?
Why does he wish us to have it?
I think perhaps he should explain that himself. He's waiting outside.
He's here? The Prime Minister glanced up sharply. Does Sir Horace know about this, or Strang?
No, sir. Nobody knows.
I'm astonished to hear it. This is not how these matters are supposed to be handled. He was frowning.
You are aware of the chain of command. You're exceeding your authority.
I understand that, sir. But it seemed to me important. He is risking his life, and he asked to see you alone.
I shouldn't have anything to do with this. This really is most improper.
He took off his spectacles and gazed into the middle distance. He tapped his foot a couple of times in irritation.
Very well, he said. Bring him in, but 5 minutes, no longer.
Leggett went to the door, opened it, and beckoned to Hartman, who was waiting at the end of the corridor. He said to the detective,
It's all right, I know him.
Then stood aside to let Hartman enter.
5 minutes, he whispered.
He closed the door. Prime Minister, this is Paul von Hartmann of the German Foreign Ministry. Chamberlain shook his hand briefly, as if prolonged contact might be contaminating.
Good evening.
He gestured towards a seat.
Make it quick.
Hartmann remained standing.
I won't sit, Prime Minister, as I don't wish to take up any more of your time than is necessary. I thank you for seeing me.
I'm not sure it is very wise for either of us, but you'd better get on with it.
The document in your hands is conclusive proof that when Hitler claims to have no further territorial demands in Europe, he is lying. On the contrary, he plans a war of conquest to gain living space for the German people. This war will be launched at a minimum within the next 5 years. The incorporation of Austria and Czechoslovakia is merely the first step. Those who expressed reservations, the commanders of the army and the foreign minister, have all been replaced. I bring this information to you in good faith and at grave risk to myself, because I wish to urge you, even at this 11th hour, not to sign the agreement tonight. It will make Hitler's position in Germany unassailable, whereas if Britain and France were to stand firm, I am certain the army would move against him in order to prevent a disastrous war. Chamberlain crossed his arms and regarded him for a few moments. Young man, I applaud your courage and your sincerity, but I'm afraid you need to learn a few lessons in political reality. It is simply impossible to expect the peoples of Britain and France to take up arms to deny the right of self-determination to ethnic Germans who are trapped in a foreign country they wish to leave. Against that single reality, all else fails. As for what Hitler dreams of doing in the next 5 years, well, we shall have to wait and see. He's been making these threats ever since Mein Kampf. My objective is clear, to avert war in the short term, and then to try to build a lasting peace for the future, 1 month at a time, 1 day at a time, if needs be. The worst act I could possibly commit for the future of mankind would be to walk away from this conference tonight. Now, he went on, folding up the memorandum, I advise you to take this document, which is the property of your government, and return it to wherever it came from. He tried to pass it over, but Hartmann refused to take it. He put his hands behind his back and shook his head. No, Prime Minister. Keep it. Have your experts study it. That is the political reality. Chamberlain drew back. Now you're being impertinent. I have no wish to be offensive, but I came to speak frankly, and I have done so. I believe that what is being done here will one day come to be seen as infamous. Well, that is my 5 minutes, I suppose. And to Leggett's astonishment, he smiled, but a terrible smile, full of agony and despair. Thank you for your time, Prime Minister. He bowed. I didn't have much hope for anything better. You. He nodded, turned smartly, like a soldier on a parade ground, and walked out of the room, closing the door quietly. Chamberlain glared after him for a few moments, then turned to Leggett. Get rid of this at once. He thrust the memorandum into his hands. His voice was cold, hard, precise, on the edge of a fury that was all the more alarming for being so tightly controlled. I simply cannot allow myself to be distracted by what may or may not have been said at a private meeting a year ago. The situation is entirely altered since last November. Yes, Prime Minister. We will not speak of this again. No, sir. Leggett moved to collect the red box from the desk, but Chamberlain stopped him. Leave it. Go. And when he reached the door, the Prime Minister added, I have to say, I'm extremely disappointed in you. The chilly words were pronounced like a professional death sentence. Leggett went out quietly into the corridor. A high flyer in the British civil service, no longer. Chapter 10 Hartmann was certain from the moment he left the hotel that he was being followed. He had an animal's sixth sense, a kind of prickling along his spine of being stalked by a predator. But there were too many people around him to be able to recognize his pursuer. The small park opposite the Regina Palast was spilling over with the Oktoberfest crowd. It was warm enough for the women still to be wearing dresses with bare arms. A lot of the men were drunk. In Karolinenplatz, an impromptu folk choir had formed beneath the obelisk, and a red-faced man with a chamois plume in his hat was waving his hands wildly in an attempt to conduct them. He walked quickly. The fools, he thought. They imagined they were celebrating peace. They had no idea what their beloved Führer had planned for them. When a couple of young women on Brienerstrasse suddenly blocked his path and invited him to join them,
He pushed his way past them without a word. They jeered at his back. He put his head down. Fools! And the greatest fool of all was Chamberlain. He stopped beneath a bare tree to light a cigarette and discreetly checked the road behind him. He allowed himself a certain bitter satisfaction. When all was said and done, he had at least got in to deliver his warning to the British Prime Minister. That was something. He could still see the affronted expression on that narrow provincial face when he had refused to take back the memorandum. Poor Hugh, standing next to him, had looked stricken. Perhaps he had ruined his career. Too bad. That could not be helped. But still he felt a pang of guilt. He glanced over his shoulder again. A figure was approaching. Despite the heat, he was wearing a belted brown raincoat. As he passed, Hartmann had a glimpse of a badly pockmarked cheek. Gestapo, he thought. They had their own smell, and they were like rats. If there was one, there would be more. He waited until the man had reached the edge of the Königsplatz and had passed out of sight beyond one of the temples of honour. Then he threw away his cigarette and set off in the direction of the Führerbau. The crowd here was much larger, several thousand at least, but more sober, as befitted their proximity to the spiritual heart of the Reich. Hartmann climbed the red-carpeted steps and went into the foyer. As it had been in the morning, it was packed with Nazi worthies. The din of braying voices echoed off the marble. He searched the porcine faces of the old comrades, and the smoother, educated countenances of those who had joined the party since 1933, until he thought he saw the pockmarks of his pursuer. But when he moved towards him, the Gestapo man vanished into the cloakroom. The clumsiness of it infuriated him. He went to the foot of the staircase and waited. Sure enough, after a couple of minutes, the black-uniformed figure of Sauer came through the door. Hartmann moved to block his path.
"Good evening, Herr Sturmbannführer."
Sauer nodded warily.
"Hartmann, I've missed you for most of the day."
"Indeed?"
"You know, I have the strangest feeling. Perhaps you can set my mind at rest. I have a sense that you've been following me."
For a moment, Sauer looked taken aback. Then outrage flashed across his face.
"You have some nerve, Hartmann."
"Well, have you?"
"Yes. Since you raised the matter, I have been investigating your activities."
"That is not a very comradely thing to do."
"I have every justification. As a result, I now know all about you and your English friend."
"I presume you mean her legate?"
"Legate, yes, legate,"
Hartmann said calmly. "We were at Oxford together."
"I know that. From 1930 until 1932, I have spoken to the personnel department of the Foreign Ministry. I have also contacted our embassy in London, who were able to establish that Leggett and you were actually in the same college."
"If you'd asked me, I could have saved you the trouble."
"It amounts to nothing."
"If that was all there was, I might agree. But I have discovered that Herr Leggett was not on the original list of British delegates that was telegraphed to Berlin last night. His name was only added this morning. A colleague of his, Herr Sires, was supposed to be coming."
Hartmann tried not to show his alarm.
"I fail to see the significance."
"Your behaviour at the station at Kufstein, telephoning Berlin to discover who would be coming from London, it struck me at the time as suspicious. Why would you be so concerned? Why were you even on the Führer's train in the first place? I now believe it was because you had requested that Leggett should come to Munich, and you wanted to make sure that he was on Chamberlain's plane."
"You overestimate my influence, Herr Sturmbannführer. I am not suggesting you arranged it personally. Some member of your group would have made the request on your behalf."
"Oh, yes, don't look surprised. We're aware of what is going on. We are not the fools you take us for."
"I should hope not."
"And now you have been observed leaving the Führerbau by a back entrance in order to walk to the hotel of the British delegation, where I saw you in the lobby with my own eyes, in conversation with Herr Leggett, before disappearing together upstairs. The whole thing stinks of treachery.
Two old friends happen to meet after a long interval. They take advantage of a lull in official business to renew their acquaintance. Where is the evidence of treachery? You are embarrassing yourself, Herr Sturmbannführer. The English are inherently hostile to the Reich. Unauthorized contacts between officials are highly suspicious. I have been doing nothing more than the Führer has been doing with Herr Chamberlain all afternoon, finding areas of common ground."
For a moment it occurred to Hartmann that Sauer was about to hit him.
We'll see whether you're so sure of yourself after I have brought the matter to the attention of the Foreign Minister.
Hartman!
The shouts carried clearly over the hubbub in the foyer. Both men looked around to see where it was coming from.
Hartman!
He glanced up. Schmidt was leaning over the balustrade, gesturing for him to join him. Excuse me, Sturmbannführer. I'll wait to hear from you and the Minister.
You will. You can be sure of it.
Hartman began to climb the stairs. His legs felt weak. He ran his hand up the cold marble banister, glad of its support. He had been careless. The former automobile salesman from Essen was proving a dogged adversary, and no fool. There must be so many pieces of circumstantial evidence he had left behind him, unguarded conversations, meetings that might have been observed, and his relationship with Frau Winter. How many people in Wilhelmstrasse had guessed at that? He wondered how robustly he would withstand interrogation. One never knew. Schmidt was waiting for him on the first floor. He looked crumpled. The effort of translating between four different languages, and of simply maintaining order long enough for his translations to be heard, had obviously drained him. He said testily,
"I've been looking for you. Where have you been?"
The British raised a query about one of the translations. I went to their hotel to sort it out with them directly. Another lie that could come easily back to trap him. But for now it seemed to satisfy Schmidt. He nodded.
"Good. The agreements are still being typed. When the delegations return for the signing, you will have to be on hand to translate."
"Of course."
"Also, first thing tomorrow morning, you will be needed back here to prepare the English-language press summary for the Führer. The telegrams will be collated in the office. You will need to get some sleep if you can. There is a room for you at the Führer Jahrzeiten."
Hartmann could not hide his alarm.
"Now that we're no longer on the train, I thought the summary would be handled by the press department." "Normally, yes. So you should be honoured. The Führer himself has requested that you should do it. You seem to have made an impression. He called you the young man with the watch."
In the lobby of the Regina Palast, the Prime Minister's party was queuing to file out of the revolving door. Chamberlain was already on the pavement. Leggett could hear the crowd in the park cheering him.
Strang said, "I haven't seen you for a while. I was starting to think you'd decided to sit this one out."
"No, sir, my apologies."
"Not that I'd have blamed you. I wouldn't have minded missing it myself."
They went out through the revolving door into the tumult of the night, the revving engines of the big Mercedes, car doors slamming along the length of the convoy, shouts, white flashbulbs, red brake lights and yellow headlights. Somewhere in the darkness, a whistle blew. For more than an hour, Leggett had been expecting the blow to fall. He had sat in the corner office, dictating to a clerk in the Foreign Office the latest amendments to the agreement, his ears cocked for voices in the corridor, waiting for the summons, the dressing down, the dismissal. Nothing. Now Wilson was settling the Prime Minister into the back of the first car. When he had finished, he swung round. He noticed Leggett. "This must be it," thought Leggett, and he braced himself. But Wilson merely grinned.
"Hello, Hugh. Going to witness history being made?"
"Yes, Sir Horace, if that's all right."
"Of course it's all right."
Leggett watched him move quickly round to the other side of the car. His friendliness was bewildering.
Strang said, "Come on, Hugh, look lively. Why don't you ride with me?"
They climbed into the third Mercedes. Henderson and Kirkpatrick were in the car in front, Ashton Gwatkin and Dunglass at the rear. When they pulled away and cornered sharply with a soft squeal of tyres, Leggett noticed that Strang didn't sway with the motion of the car, but remained as stiff and immobile. He was hating every moment. The cortege accelerated along Max Josef Strasse and across Karolinenplatz, the wind hard in their faces. Leggett wondered if he would see Hartmann at the Führerbau. He didn't resent him for embarrassing him in front of the Prime Minister. It had been a futile gesture, of course, but then they were trapped in an era where futile gestures were all that were available. Powell had got it right that night when he had stood on the parapet of Magdalen Bridge. "Ours is a mad generation." Their destinies had been mapped from the moment they met. The convoy came into Königsplatz. It looked even more pagan in the darkness, its giant symbols and eternal flames and floodlit white buildings glittering around a vast expanse of black granite, like the temple complex of some lost civilization. By the time their car drew to a halt, the Prime Minister was already out of his Mercedes and halfway up the steps to the Führerbau. He was in such a hurry that for once he didn't stop to acknowledge the large crowd, even though they were chanting his name. They carried on, cheering after he had disappeared inside. Strang said, "What an astonishing reception he gets, wherever he goes in Germany. It was exactly the same in Bad Godesberg. I'm beginning to think that if he could stand for election, he'd give Hitler a run for his money." An SS man stepped up and opened the door. He shuddered slightly. "Well, let's get it over with." The foyer was packed and brilliantly lit. Adjutants in white jackets circulated with trays of drinks. Strang went off to find Malkin. Left to himself, Leggett wandered round, holding a glass of mineral water, keeping an eye out for Hartman. He saw Dunglass making his way over towards him. "Hello, Alec."
"Hugh, some of our press chaps outside are complaining. Apparently no one from a British paper is to be allowed in to take a picture of the actual signing. I was wondering if you could possibly ask if something might be done about it."
"I can try."
"Could you? Best to keep them happy."
He disappeared into the crowd. Leggett handed his glass to a waiter and began to climb the stairs. He paused halfway up and gazed around the balustraded gallery, unsure who he should approach. One of the uniformed figures, an officer of the SS, detached himself from the rest and descended to meet him.
"Good evening. You look lost."
He spoke in German. There was a strange dead fish quality about his pale blue eyes. "Can I help you?"
"Good evening. Thank you, yes. I wanted to talk to someone about the press arrangements for the signing of the agreement."
"Of course. Come with me, please."
He gestured for Leggett to walk with him up to the first floor.
"There is an official of the Foreign Ministry who is doing much of the liaison work with our British guests."
He led him around to the seating area at the front of the building, where Hartman was standing beside one of the pillars.
"You know Herr Hartman, perhaps?"
Leggett pretended not to have heard.
"Herr Leggett?"
repeated the SS man. His voice was louder, less friendly.
"I asked you a question. Do you know Herr Hartman?"
"I don't believe..." Hartman cut in.
"My dear Hugh, I think that Sturmbannführer Sauer is having a little joke with you. He knows perfectly well that we're old friends, and that I came to see you in your hotel this evening. He knows it because he and his friends in the Gestapo followed me there."
Leggett managed to smile.
"Well, there's your answer. We've known one another for many years. Why do you ask? Is there a problem?"
Sauer said,
"You replaced a colleague on Herr Chamberlain's plane at the last minute, I believe."
"That's right."
"Might I ask why?"
"Because I speak better German than he does."
"But surely that was known from the start?"
"Everything was a bit last minute."
"And there are people from your embassy in Berlin who can act as translators?"
Hartman said,
"Really, Sauer, I don't think you have the right to cross-examine a man who is a guest in our country."
Sauer ignored him.
"And before today, you and Hartman last met when, may I ask?"
6 years ago. Not that it's any of your business."
"Good."
Sauer nodded. Suddenly his confidence seemed to be running out.
"Well, I shall leave you to talk. No doubt Hartman will tell you everything you want to know."
He clicked his heels, bowed slightly, and walked away. Leggett said,
"That was ominous."
"Oh, take no notice of him. He is determined to expose me. He will keep digging until he finds something, but he hasn't got anything yet. And now we must assume we are being watched, so we must play our parts. What is it you want to know?"
"Can the British press send in a photographer to record the signing? Who should I ask?"
"Don't bother. It has already been decided. The only still camera permitted in the room will belong to the Führer's personal photographer, Hoffmann, whose assistant, so rumour has it, our not-so-celibate leader, is fucking."
He put his hand on Leggett's shoulder and said quietly,
"I apologize if my actions tonight embarrassed you.
Think nothing of it. I'm only sorry it wasn't more fruitful." He touched the front of his inside pocket where the memorandum was folded into three.
"What would you like me to do with..."
"Keep it. Hide it in your room. Take it back with you to London and make sure it reaches a more responsive audience." Hartman squeezed his shoulder and released it. Now, for both our sakes, we should stop talking and move apart. I'm afraid it would be better if we did not speak again. Another hour dragged by. Leggett waited in the British delegation's room with the others while the documents were finalized. Nobody spoke much. He kept to himself in the corner. He found to his surprise that he could contemplate the imminent wreckage of his career with equanimity. No doubt this was the anaesthetic of tiredness. He was sure that when he got back to London he would feel differently, but for now he was sanguine. He tried to imagine telling Pamela that her dreams of becoming the chatelaine of the Paris embassy were no longer feasible. Perhaps he would leave the diplomatic service altogether. Her father had once offered to help find him a nice little berth in the city. Maybe he should take him up on it. It would solve their financial worries, at least until war came. It was 12:30 when Dunglass finally put his head round the door.
"The agreement's about to be signed. The PM wants everyone to be there."
Leggett would have preferred not to attend, but there was no escape. He rose wearily from his chair and walked with his colleagues along the corridor towards Hitler's study. At the door of the big office, a crowd of minor players, aides, adjutants, civil servants, Nazi Party officials, had gathered. They parted to let them through. Inside, the heavy green velvet curtains had all been drawn, but the windows must have been opened, because Leggett could hear the movement of the crowd outside quite distinctly, like a gently moving sea, occasionally ruffled by eddies of shouts and singing. The room was packed. At the opposite end, standing around the desk, were Hitler, Göring, Himmler, Hess, Ribbentrop, Mussolini, and Ciano. They were studying a map. Not seriously, it seemed to him, but for the benefit of a photographer using a handheld newsreel camera. He filmed them first from one side and then scampered round to do the same from the front, while Chamberlain and Daladier watched the proceedings from the hearth. All eyes were on Hitler. He was the only one talking. Occasionally he pointed and made sweeping gestures. Finally, he folded his arms and stepped back, and the filming ended. There was no sound recording equipment, Leggett noticed. It was like watching the making of some strange, silent movie. He glanced at Chamberlain. The Prime Minister seemed to have been waiting for an opportunity. He left Wilson and went forward and spoke to Hitler, who listened to the translation, nodded vigorously a couple of times. Leggett heard the famous harsh voice, "Yeah, yeah." The exchange lasted less than a minute. The Prime Minister returned to the fireplace. He looked pleased with himself. For an instant his gaze rested on Leggett, then almost immediately switched away to Mussolini, who had come over to talk to him. Göring waddled around, rubbing his hands. Himmler's round, rimless spectacles flashed in the light of the chandelier like two blind discs. After another minute or two, a small procession of officials entered, carrying the various documents that made up the agreement. At the back of the group was Hartmann. Leggett noticed how carefully he avoided looking at anyone. The map was rolled up and removed from the desk, and the papers were laid out. The photographer, a thick-set man of about 50 with wavy grey hair, Hoffmann, presumably, gestured for the leaders to stand together. They grouped themselves awkwardly with their backs to the fireplace, Chamberlain on the left in his pinstriped suit, with his watch chain and high-winged collar like a waxwork in a museum of Victoriana, Daladier next to him, mournful, also pinstriped but smaller and with a protruding stomach. Then Hitler, impassive, pasty-faced and dead-eyed, with his hands folded together over his crotch, and at the end Mussolini, a brooding expression on his large, fleshy face. The silence was palpable, as if nobody wished to be there, like guests at an arranged wedding. The moment the photograph was taken, the group broke up. Ribbentrop indicated the desk. Hitler went over to it. A young SS adjutant handed him a pair of spectacles. They changed his face in an instant, made him look fussy and pedantic. He peered down at the document. The adjutant gave him a pen. He dipped it into the inkstand, examined the nib, frowned, straightened, and pointed irritably. The inkstand was empty. There was an uneasy shifting in the room. Göring rubbed his hands together and laughed. One of the officials pulled out his own fountain pen and gave it to Hitler. Again he bent forwards and studied the paper carefully, then very quickly scribbled his signature. One aide rolled a semicircular blotter over the wet ink, then a second lifted away the document, and a third slid another sheet of paper in front of Hitler. He scribbled again. The same procedure was repeated. It went on for several minutes, 20 times in all, a copy of the main agreement for each of the four powers, along with the various annexes and supplementary declarations, the fruit of some of the most creative legal brains in Europe, which had enabled them to slide over matters of contention, postpone them for later haggling, and reach a settlement in less than 12 hours. When Hitler had finished, he tossed the fountain pen casually onto the desk and turned away. Chamberlain was the next to step up to the desk. He, too, put on a pair of spectacles, which he was as reluctant as the Führer to be seen wearing in public, took out his pen and scrutinized what he was about to sign. His jaw worked slightly back and forth, and then carefully he wrote out his name. From outside came a burst of cheering, as if the crowd knew what was happening at that moment. Chamberlain was too absorbed to react. But Hitler grimaced and gestured to the window, and an adjutant parted the curtains and closed the sash. In the shadows at the back of the study, Hartmann watched it all without seeing, his long face blank and ashy with exhaustion. Like a ghost, thought Leggett. Like a man already dead. Day 4. Chapter 1. In his bedroom in the Regina Palast Hotel, Hugh Leggett was asleep. He was splayed out on his back, fully clothed and unconscious, his head lolling to one side, like a drowned man fished out of the sea. The light was still on in the bathroom. The door was slightly ajar. The room was cast in a pale, bluish light. At one time there had been voices in the corridor outside. He had recognized Strang, then Ashton Gwatkin, and there had been footsteps. But the Prime Minister had at last gone to bed, and gradually these extraneous sounds had ceased, and now there was only the rhythm of his breathing and his occasional muttered cry. He dreamed that he was flying. He was too deeply asleep to hear the noise of his door handle being tried. What woke him was the tapping. It was soft at first, more like a scratching of fingernails on wood, and when he opened his eyes he assumed it was one of the children trying to clamber into their bed after a nightmare. But then he saw the unfamiliar room, and he remembered where he was. He squinted at the luminous hands on the hotel's alarm clock, 3:30. The noise came again. He reached out and turned on the bedside lamp. The memorandum lay on the nightstand. He rolled off his bed, opened the drawer of the desk, and inserted it into the hotel's guide to Munich. The floor creaked as he crossed to the door. He touched the handle, but at the last moment some instinct warned him not to turn it.
"Who's there?" "It's Paul."
The German loomed on the threshold, absurd in his conspicuousness. Leggett pulled him into the room and glanced quickly up and down the corridor. Nobody was stirring. The detective must be spending the night in the Prime Minister's sitting room. He closed the door. Hartmann was going around the bedroom, collecting Leggett's overcoat, his hat, his shoes. "Put these on."
"What on earth for? Quickly, I want to show you something." "Are you mad? At this hour? It's the only time we have."
Leggett was still half asleep. He rubbed his face and shook his head in an effort to fully wake himself.
"What is it you want me to see?" "If I tell you that, you won't come."
In his determination, he seemed almost demented. He held out the shoes.
"Please. Paul, this is dangerous."
Hartmann gave a short bark of laughter.
"Do you think you have to point out that to me?"
He threw the shoes onto the bed. "I shall be at the back of the hotel. I shall wait for you outside. If you are not there in 10 minutes, I shall know you're not coming." After he had gone, Leggett paced up and down his small room for a minute. The situation was so preposterous he could almost believe he had dreamt the whole thing. He sat on the edge of the mattress and picked up his shoes. He had been too tired to take them off properly before he went to sleep. Now he found he couldn't unpick the laces, even with his teeth. He had to stand and kick his toes into the shoes and lever in his heels with his fingers. He felt angry. He was also, he would admit it to himself, frightened. He put on his hat and draped his coat over his arm. He went out into the corridor and locked the door behind him. turned left and walked quickly around the corner towards the rear staircase. At the bottom he passed the entrance to the Turkish baths. A moist aroma of steam and sweet oils briefly released memories of the gentlemen's clubs of Pall Mall, and then he was out through the glass doors and into the small street at the back of the hotel. Hartman was smoking a cigarette, leaning against the bodywork of one of the open-topped black Mercedes they had been driving around in all day. The engine was ticking over. He grinned when he saw Leggett, dropped the cigarette into the gutter, and ground it up.